Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It was the U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearing that descended into chaos before it even began. Yet the groundwork for the partisan battle over the Brett Kavanaugh hearings was laid decades before the confirmation hearings over another controversial conservative judge, Robert Bork. Frontline's Supreme Revenge premieres tonight at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV and online at pbs.org/frontline. Today, we welcome producer and reporter Gabrielle Chandler to In the Moment. Welcome back. Thanks for being here with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lori.
This frontline, I think, puts it gives you an in-depth look and puts in the chronology that a lot of people were sort of talking about because this is history that a lot of us have lived through. But nobody could really, in my circle anyway, put their fingers on everything that had led up to the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, and this Supreme Revenge really does. So we need to start with Robert Bork. Because this is during President Reagan's, he's a Reagan nominee, and this is also, at that time, Mitch McConnell's first term in Congress. So tell us about Robert Bork and who he is. What does he represent that makes such a firestorm begin on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so Robert Bork is effectively one of the most sort of notable conservative judges in the country at the time. He had a strong reputation as a great conservative thinker. He was a former law professor at Yale Law School and was really sort of a hero on the right. His name was not a big surprise when the nomination was first announced, and yet it was an incredible shock if you were on the left side of the aisle. And as we sort of see very early on, Ted Kennedy sort of takes on the Bork nomination and really sort of creates this this new sort of environment in which a presidential nominee is really sort of in the crosshairs. This was in many ways one of the first battles over a Supreme Court nominee, and so we were very curious in watching the Kavanaugh hearings to know, you know, gosh, if we were to go back into the time machine, when did this sort of open warfare over the courts really begin? And we sort of felt like it was with Judge Robert Bork. And so then we began to look at, well, who were the key figures behind that nomination? And a freshman senator named Mitch McConnell, who had a full head of hair, caught our attention.
And you thought, there's something there. Let's keep looking. So when Senator Ted Kennedy gets up and talks about Robert Bork, he paints a picture that is intentionally terrifying. This is what's going to happen to women. This is what's going to happen to civil rights. Everything goes backwards. What is he talking about? That surprised a lot of people. Was he looking at Bork's record? Was it just a purely partisan speech from Ted Kennedy?
Great question. You know, it really was, certainly conservative views that Judge Bork had had over a long storied career. Now, the great difference was, of course, that Ted Kennedy was sort of creating kind of this case against Bork in a way in which his views were really sort of organized and put forth in a really sort of dark view of what the country could look like if, in fact, a conservative justice was to be appointed. So it's a mix of both. Yes, these were conservative views that Judge Bork held. However, the attack on the judge's ideology was certainly quite quite inflamed.
Let's talk about the role of television and, the media or journalism, because you have Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota. Everybody's watching. Mitch McConnell is watching. Everybody is watching how Robert Bork gets treated. And that means something for the future, because why? Tell us what the role of the hearings being broadcast in the way that they were. Why did that make a difference?
It was really sort of one of the first moments in which, a Senate committee hearing is televised. The way in which The entire room is set up, is sort of made for TV. It's a very dramatic sort of filming. The lights that are on Judge Bork are not very flattering. It's a very sort of high intensity moment. And it really does sort of capture the attention of the country. It's one of, you know, the very first times we see, a Senate hearing play out in this type of manner. And yet, I think we can all now say, looking back, this is a show we've all seen a few more times since then.
Yeah. Mitch McConnell, after the confirmation is defeated, Robert Bork will not be a U.S. Supreme Court judge. Mitch McConnell says, essentially, we're going to do this to you, too. I mean, he makes no there's no subtlety in his message, just like there was no subtlety in Ted Kennedy's message. We're coming for you when you least expect it.
Absolutely. And it's a promise he obviously continues to deliver on. What was just remarkable is how far back he sort of decided to sort of announce this threat. I mean, we're talking 30 years that Mitch McConnell has committed to being sort of a tactician of you know, turning the court and remaking the court in a certain image of conservative legal minds. And so it's pretty remarkable to see a grudge last this long.
Yeah.
I think it's even more fascinating as observers of Washington that we are to certainly see that bet pay off.
And it, part of me, he's a first year or first term senator at that point. Who does he think he is? You know, the courage or the sort of, I don't know. He's got some oomph there to get up and say, this is coming for you. Does he make his political career somewhat at that moment?
Yeah, I think it's a great analysis. I think he does. I mean, he certainly inserts himself into, not just the election cycle, not just proceeding over, you know, Senate business, but sort of taking on this other branch of government and inserting himself into that process. And I think that's what's so remarkable. And I think that's what he hasn't received a lot of credit for over the years, because it's been a little bit quieter of a crusade. But it's certainly it's been very profitable for him. I think he made a calculation pretty early on that the playbook that Ted Kennedy had really sort of shared with him was something he would actually emulate and then ultimately perfect.
Yeah. So on that topic, the Federalist Society, tell us about how they sort of came to be and who they are now.
Yeah. So the Federalist Society started as an organization, a student organization at Yale Law School and the University of Chicago Law School. And the two initial academic advisors were Antonin Scalia at Chicago and Judge Robert Bork at Yale. And from there, you had sort of two chapters that really sort of gave law students an opportunity, conservative law students an opportunity to have their voices heard. The feeling at that time was that, you know, many of the great minds in the legal community and in the legal network were generally more progressive and more liberal. And so the idea of sort of building a grassroots movement of great right conservative thinkers was something pretty revolutionary. And it's quite fascinating now to see in three decades how that network has grown. Obviously, these are, you know, two very high-profile law schools, but undoubtedly they were sort of very early efforts to recruit and to create sort of this much larger group of conservative attorneys. And so now you see, certainly the last several conservative justices appointed to the Supreme Court who are members of the Federalist Society. Mitch McConnell, a very active member. Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, is a very active member. And their ability now to fundraise in order to support their efforts to pick and support rising judges throughout sort of the court systems is pretty astounding.
So a lot of us, I think myself included, I don't want to think that there are conservative judges and progressive or liberal judges. To me, you're interpreting, and I'm wondering how much that has to do with money. If you're in law school and you're trying to make a career, is there pressure now to sort of say, I am one or the other, because that's who's going to get funded and networked and helped to the next level of your career. We all thought that judges were supposed to be impartial.
Yes, imagine that. Well, yeah. I think you also sort of see the transformation of that in our film. I mean, certainly the one thing we can say about Judge Robert Bork is that he answers questions posed to him by the Senate committee at the time. Honestly, he gives his, you know, his you know, full candid responses. And very quickly, judges and those around judges who are sort of going through the nomination process learn that, hey, saying anything about your personal views is a big, big mistake. Look at what happened to Bork. Well, you've got to learn from this. And so what you see certainly in the Thomas hearings and then ultimately in the Kavanaugh hearings are judges who are effectively saying nothing. I mean, they are really giving as little information as possible in order to not risk their nominations. And so it's tough as, you know, as members of the public to know what are their positions. And it's certainly tough when you're watching these hearings to hear, you know, whether there's anything actually being discussed. And so it is really hard to vet these folks. And so we look to organizations like the Federalist Society to know, oh, well, if the judge is aligned with them, he must be X, Y, and Z. But I think you're right to say the influence of money, the influence of partisan outside groups, you know, the idea that you are now either a blue or a red justice is, gosh, these are themes that have certainly been playing out in the background over the course of history. But we're sort of seeing really a new battle unlike anything else.
So this brings us to Clarence Thomas, who is nominated by George H. Bush after the retirement of Thurgood Marshall. And he really almost says nothing and he's prepped, you know, look at what happened to Bork, like you said. That didn't have to work, but it was effective. And then I did not know this. I did not know that NPR's Nina Totenberg is the person who found Anita Hill. So there's a journalism story there. She hears Joe Biden say something in the hearings that makes her perk up her ears about the word character. Tell us a little bit about how we find out how the hearings are going and how Anita Hill changes that so dramatically.
So much like the Kavanaugh hearings, things are sort of progressing normally. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, pretty late into the process, Senate Committee Chairman Joe Biden says this really sort of offhand remark about accusations against Clarence Thomas' character. And the room sort of has no idea what he means by that. And Nina Totenberg, an NPR correspondent at the time, hears that this sort of new detail and thinks, what's he referring to? And what does he mean? And begins sort of kicking the tires and very quickly realizes there is a woman who has accused Judge Thomas of sexual harassment while he was working at the equal opportunity employer. And it's a commission that's charged with protecting folks who are accusing employers of sexual harassment. And so it's this like remarkable moment in which a, you know, Yale-educated judge and a Yale-educated attorney working underneath him have this really terrible case. And so it slowly comes to light because Nina Totenberg does a story on Anita Hill. And I believe she describes the accusations and certainly the revelation of the Hill moment as a mushroom cloud over Washington.
And that we're going to jump ahead a little bit, because one of the questions I really want to ask you is, when you look at what happened with Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford, and then Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, both Thomas and Kavanaugh say, Thomas says this is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks. He, you know, really said, you don't want me, people don't want me on the Supreme Court. They're going to do anything. Kavanaugh said this is a partisan smear campaign. But the validity of what Blasey Ford and what Anita Hill are saying is never really effectively addressed. They use it as as evidence that somebody is out to get them, and they deny. But what's happening there with this, like what's happening behind the scenes with Mitch McConnell and President Trump and the people who are making the phone calls to say, at this point, should we just go down to somebody else on the list or do we stick with our guy? And why stick with somebody when that is in their background?
It's pretty remarkable to see the amount of focus and determination Mitch McConnell has, especially throughout the Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, you know, this is a moment in which Kellyanne Conway, who's in our film, and President Trump are watching Dr. Blasey Ford, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, this is compelling. This is really honest, and this is really raw. And it's Mitch McConnell who makes the call to the White House to say, you know, guys, let's keep going. This is not the end of the game. I'm stronger than mule piss, and I've seen worse. And so effectively, it's this idea that we won't acknowledge the attack, the crime that perhaps is being discussed. We are just focusing on the nominee. We are just focusing on the politics of this, right? The idea that this is an attack on our guy and on our team. And so it's a pretty, different view of what the issue is at hand. I think, you know, certainly most Democrats on the Senate committee and Republicans, I think Jeff Flake at a certain point is really, of course, taken and moved by protesters who are there to defend Dr. Blasey Ford. And so there's an acknowledgement that, like, we have to get to the bottom of the truth of whether this, you know, act took place, whereas the folks who are really pushing, certainly the nominee, have this idea that, you know, we have to move this through as quickly as possible before anything, any other unknown comes to the public's eye.
And we're just scratching the surface of this, but when you look back at all the work that you've put into this frontline investigation, what stands out to you is what's at stake? Because it seems like a lot to me. It seems very heavy at the end, right? What have we lost if we lose a bipartisan Supreme Court nomination process? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think there's two things. One is that, you know, for some time we've lost our focus on the courts. And I think that there has been this sort of more subtle, more nuanced, more driven campaign to control the court and to remake the court in one particular party's, you know, view. And I think that that's a really dangerous thing. I think that as you said earlier, that the courts are supposed to be impartial. They're supposed to be sort of preserved from the politics of our day. And what we've sort of seen happening is this like slow politicization of the courts, of judges, of the process. And that's a pretty new phenomenon. It started some time ago, and we've seen it also at the lower courts. But goodness, it's really wild to see what has sort of once become sort of a very, you know, clear-cut process that a president's, you know, judicial nominee would be approved and voted on is not always a given. I mean, we go back to Judge Garland, who I just can't believe, right, you know, never received a hearing, let alone meetings with the Senate Minority Leader at the time. And so it's a pretty remarkable thing to just see our politics getting in the way of our governing.
Fascinating look at Mitch McConnell and the U.S. Supreme Court and what's happened in the past and where we're headed. Gabrielle Schonder, producer and reporter for Frontline Supreme Revenge. That's on tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV. You can watch online at pbs.org/frontline. That's where you can find all the supplemental interviews and details about that as well. Gabrielle, thank you so much for being here once again. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Lori.